Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update on mantle cell lymphoma. Today's program is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care and many other organizations as well. And it's because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 515 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Mexico, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. Today's program actually has been made possible and supported through unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Celgene Corporation and Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program and also for their collaborative effort. I also want to point out that the Lymphoma Research Foundation has played a critically important role in making today's program possible, both in terms of support for the program, but also as being architects for the program itself and in terms of helping to structure and identify speakers and topics for the program as well. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, the topics they'll be addressing. There also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as resources for each of you, and there is an evaluation form. And I would ask you each to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, you are the best people to tell us the programs we should be offering. Indeed, today's program is one that many of you have requested, and we are offering it. We try very much to meet the needs that you request in terms of topics, and so please take a moment and tell us the topics that you would like us to address. Now, we have a wonderful program planned today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Oliver Press. And Dr. Press is member of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, recipient Dr. Penny E. Peterson Memorial Chair for Lymphoma Research, professor of medicine, University of Washington, co-chair NCI Lymphoma Steering Committee. And Dr. Press is going to address mantle cell lymphoma overview. He'll provide an overview of mantle cell lymphoma. He'll discuss treatment options for the newly diagnosed and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Press.
Thank you. Well, my topic is to give you an overview of mantle cell lymphoma. Mantle cell lymphoma, as you probably know, is one of more than 60 types of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. All of the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas are cancers of the immune system of a cell type called a lymphocyte, and when that lymphocyte undergoes a mutation that causes it to grow too much, one develops a lymphoma. The particular type we're dealing with today, mantle cell lymphoma, makes up about 6% of all the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas in the United States, and there are about 5,000 new cases per year. It's a disease that's much more common in men than women. There are three men with mantle cell lymphoma for every woman who develops the disease. And it typically presents in patients between the age of 50 and 75 is the typical age range. The most common clinical presentation is for a patient to develop enlarged lymph nodes, usually in the neck, under the arms, or in the groin. And usually the lymph nodes are not tender until they get very large. Alternatively, some patients will develop infiltration of either the liver or the spleen and so might get abdominal distension from a large liver or spleen. Or sometimes the disease involves the bowel or the colon, and there can be symptoms related to bowel movements or abdominal discomfort in occasional cases or bleeding in the stools. Occasionally, patients will also have fever or chills or sweats. Or develop recurrent infections. The best way of establishing the diagnosis is by performing a lymph node biopsy, and usually the best way to do that is by taking out an entire lymph node, what's called an excisional biopsy. Sometimes an adequate diagnosis can be made with a core needle biopsy where there's a substantial piece of tissue still removed, but it's not a good idea to try to make the diagnosis with just a skinny needle or fine needle aspirate. Usually that doesn't give enough material to make a sound diagnosis. And once the biopsy is made, the pathologists figure out that it's mantle cell lymphoma, partially by looking at it under the microscope, but more importantly, special tests need to be done to separate out mantle cell from the other more than 60 types of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And this distinction is very important because treatments are different for different kinds of lymphomas. And the types of tests that secure the diagnosis are, first of all, chromosome tests, because the mutation that leads to mantle cell lymphoma involves a breakage of chromosomes 11 and 14. So the part of the 14th chromosome is stuck on number 11 in mantle cell lymphoma and vice versa. So that's a very definitive test. Secondly, there is a protein called cyclin D1 that's found in mantle cell lymphoma and isn't found in other lymphomas. So that's another test that's very definitive. And then flow cytometry is a special test looking at the types of molecules on the surface of the lymphoma. And there's a specific one called CD5 that isn't on many other lymphomas but is on mantle cell lymphoma. So those are three special tests that help secure the diagnosis. Once the doctor and the patient are sure that mantle cell lymphoma is the right diagnosis, then there usually is a staging workup to determine how far the disease has spread. And this includes doing a variety of blood tests. Sometimes the lymphoma circulates in the bloodstream. It includes doing CAT scans and sometimes positron emission tomography or PET scans. Bone marrow aspirate and biopsy is usually done since the bone marrow is more often than not involved. And very frequently, either colonoscopy or endoscopy might be done because the bowel is often a site of involvement of mantle cell lymphoma. And once those tests are done, one establishes a stage. Stage one means that there's just one site of disease. Stage two is two or more sites, but all on the same side of the diaphragm. Stage three is involvement both above and below the diaphragm. And stage four is if there are deep involvement of the bone marrow, the liver, or some other deep organ. The vast majority of patients have advanced stage disease, that is stages 3 or 4 at the time they're diagnosed, because mantle cell lymphoma tends to migrate around the body very early on. There are also a variety of tests and calculations that the doctor does to determine whether this particular patient is going to have an aggressive course with the mantle cell lymphoma or whether they're going to have a smoldering, indolent, well-behaved course. And there are several tests that can be done. First of all, under the microscope, you can see how many of the lymphoma cells are dividing or proliferating. And so the proliferation index is an important key. There's also a mantle cell international prognostic index that can be calculated. It's sort of a numerical number you come up with by factoring in the age of the patient, how active they are, what their lactate dehydrogenase level and their white count is. And so with that, you get a score, and it kind of tells you how rapidly the disease is likely to grow. And then there are certain variants under the microscope, like the lymphoblastoid variant, that tend to be nastier than the average case. So the doctor uses that information to talk to the patient and to try to decide which treatment is best. And that does bring me to treatment for mantle cell lymphoma. And the first thing I need to say is this is very controversial. This is maybe the most controversial type of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It was only really appreciated and studied well starting in the 1990s, and so we don't have a long track record of high-quality clinical trials. And virtually every major medical meeting has debates between various experts on what the best treatment of mantle cell lymphoma should be. There are some patients with a very early stage or good prognostic score that some doctors feel could be not treated at all initially, but have watchful waiting or observation alone. That makes up maybe 10% of patients with mantle cell lymphoma. Dr. Leonard at Cornell has been a key proponent of this approach for a subset of patients. And then there are some patients with very limited disease, just in one area or one or two areas, where radiation may play a substantial role, as studies in Vancouver have suggested. But for the vast majority of patients, 85 to 90% will have disease that's spread throughout the body and really needs systemic treatment with chemotherapy along with a monoclonal antibody called Rituxan. And there are three common induction regimens, that is, three common frontline treatments that are used. And experts do not all agree on which of them is the best one to use, and it probably varies from patient to patient. One of the most commonly used regimens now involves a chemotherapy drug called bendamustine, given along with Rituxan. Those drugs are usually given on cycles every 28 days for six cycles. And bendamustine and Rituxan is probably the best tolerated of the three popular regimens. The second regimen, and the one that's been around the longest, is the use of R-CHOP. That's a very common regimen for many kinds of lymphomas. And it is effective, at least initially, in causing shrinkage of lymph nodes in mantle cell lymphoma. Recent studies have shown that giving it along with another regimen called DHAP, perhaps alternating or giving them in sequence, may give more long-lasting remissions than giving R-CHOP by itself. So that's the second common type of treatment. And the third most common type of treatment is giving a very aggressive regimen called Rituxan and Hyper-CVAD. This is a very intense regimen that was developed at MD Anderson and probably gives longer remissions by itself than the other two regimens, but it's also much more toxic. About 90% of patients will get complete remissions with it, but it's not well tolerated over the age of 60, and so most doctors would not use it in patients who were either frail or much beyond the age of 60. Well, most of those regimens are given for several monthly cycles, often six cycles, and then most of the patients will have a good response and a so-called remission. And then the question is, should anything further be done? And many doctors, including I myself, think that the longest and the best remissions and the best chances of keeping the patient from having a recurrence of the disease is if the remission is consolidated with an autologous stem cell transplant, that is, using high-dose chemotherapy followed by reinfusion of the patient's own blood stem cells, seems to produce much longer remissions. And so that's an approach that's often used. There's a lot of debates about how old a patient can be and still tolerate an autologous transplant well, but in our center at least, we routinely do transplants into the early 70s. Other centers won't do them in patients that age, but it's variable from center to center. A second approach after obtaining a remission is to use Rituxan maintenance, that is to give a dose of the monoclonal antibody rituximab every 3 months, every 2 to 3 months, for an indefinite period of time. Some people give it for 2 years, and some people, particularly for mantle cell, will give it indefinitely. And there was a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that, particularly in elderly people, that that this approach prolonged both the remission duration and the survival of patients. And so that's a very common practice nowadays. So I think I've pointed out that there are still lots of debates about what to do with mantle cell, but I think the encouraging news is that it's quite clear that the outcome of mantle cell lymphoma is much better now than in the 1990s. We've at least doubled the survival of patients, and so treatments are continuously getting better. And as you will hear shortly from Owen O'Connor, there are many exciting new treatments coming up. The last thing I'm going to talk about is the importance of communicating with your healthcare team, that is your doctor, the nurses, social workers, et cetera, because lymphoma is a very complicated disease, and mantle cell lymphoma is a very special case with special considerations. And the treatment often should be individualized, different treatments for different patients depending on their ages, what other diseases they have. And so talking this through with the doctor is very important. Furthermore, you should discuss the availability of clinical trials, because the most exciting treatments are often only available on a clinical trial, certainly the most exciting drugs right now. And so finding out about their availability is a good idea. And also, there are a variety of supportive care issues that need to be considered. Social work issues, depression is common, pain, symptom mitigation, and also considerations of financial assistance. So I think it's very important to feel comfortable talking to your doctor and the other members of the healthcare team. So thank you. I think I've more than used up my time, and I thank you for your attendance today.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Press. That was wonderful, and really appreciate your remarks. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Owen O'Connor, and Dr. O'Connor is Professor of Medicine and Experimental Therapeutics, Director, Center for Lymphoid Malignancies, Department of Medicine. He's Co-Director, Program of Lymphoid Development and Malignancies, Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center at Columbia University Medical Center at the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. O'Connor is going to address treatment options for relapsed refractory disease, clinical trials and emerging treatment approaches, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you to all that you do and to the Lymphoma Research Foundation for putting on this important educational opportunity for patients. As Dr. Press just alluded to, mantle cell lymphoma is a relatively rare disease, but it is a disease where I think we're making dramatic strides in our ability to improve the outcome of patients with the disease, both by better understanding which patients need to be treated in a more aggressive fashion, by identifying patients with aggressive disease versus patients that might have slower growing disease. And we're also doing a much better job at being able to help patients manage relapse disease after it has come back after initial therapy. And as I'll talk about in a moment, many of the drugs that we're now using to target mantle cell lymphoma, certainly mantle cell lymphoma that has relapsed, are really not so chemotherapy oriented. Many of these drugs are actually new drugs targeting some of the unique biological features of the disease. Many of them are oral, and many of them as single agents just by themselves are producing very dramatic responses in patients, and responses that happen to be durable. As many of you are probably well aware, the first drug ever approved for the treatment of patients with relapsed or refractory mantle cell lymphoma was a drug called bortezomib. It's a proteasome inhibitor, and we were among a couple of the groups that helped identify this unique activity in mantle cell lymphoma. And that study, which was conducted back in the early 2000s, leading to approval in 2006 or so, was a registration-directed study, a study that was designed to help get approval of the drug by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. It actually looked at over 140 patients with mantle cell lymphoma. So one thing to think about as we look at rare diseases like mantle cell lymphoma is how important it is to do clinical trials, as you heard about. And enrolling over 140 patients with this rare disease can be a challenge, but this particular trial accrued relatively rapidly. And what they demonstrated is that in patients that had seen a lot of different chemotherapy programs, they were able to identify a response rate of about 33%, 8% of whom developed complete responses to the bortezomib-based therapy, and that the single agent of bortezomib, just bortezomib by itself, produced durations of benefit of about 9 months for all those patients that had a response, about 13.5 months, so over a year for those patients that had a documented complete remission. Right now, after bortezomib, there are new proteasome inhibitors that are being developed, and many of these proteasome inhibitors are actually oral drugs. So bortezomib is administered on a day 1, 4, 8, and 11 schedule. So it's an effective therapy, but it has an inconvenient schedule for patients because they have to come in twice a week. So the trend has been toward trying to develop oral versions of this drug that are just now making their way into the clinic, and I have no doubt that in the near future, there'll be additional studies looking at some of these newer oral versions of bortezomib and its related cousins in mantle cell lymphoma. Well, just last month, in fact, the FDA approved the second drug for the treatment of patients with relapsed and refractory disease, and that drug is called lenalidomide. Lenalidomide is a truly unique drug that has been around for a little while. It's actually been approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for the treatment of multiple myeloma and for patients with certain kinds of myelodysplastic syndromes. But there's been a lot of data that's come out of some colleagues at the Mayo Clinic that has established that lenalidomide is very, very active in many forms of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, including mantle cell lymphoma. Lenalidomide is really unique because it's an oral drug, and it's not really a chemotherapy drug. It's a drug that actually seems to teach your immune system how to recognize the lymphoma in your body as foreign and actually helps your body mount an immune response against that specific disease. So it's a truly unique form of therapy for these types of diseases. And a lot of early work done by the group in the Mayo Clinic and others around the country demonstrated early on that the mantle cell lymphoma seemed to be particularly sensitive to this lenalidomide-based therapy. So that actually led to a very large study that enrolled over 134 patients. So a second trial enrolling a large number of patients with this rare disease. And they recently documented that about 30% of the patients enrolled on that trial experienced a benefit, and that's despite the fact that those patients, again, had seen most of the active chemotherapy drugs for this disease. Again, about 8% or so of them had a complete remission, and the median duration of those responses were, again, quite significant for those patients that had a response over nearly a year and a half of benefit. So if you sort of think about many of the chemotherapies and you look at the benefit of these chemotherapies, we use most of those drugs in combination. And here now are two examples of drugs used as single agents in patients that have had lots of different chemotherapy programs. And as single agents, these drugs are producing respectable response rates with very respectable durations of benefit. And you might imagine then that the best way for us to think about the future use of these drugs is to try to figure out how best to integrate them into many of those induction regimens that Dr. Press just spoke about. And there's little doubt that, in fact, the rational integration of these drugs into those conventional standards of care for the disease are going to actually lead to even better improvements in patient outcome. Well, there are three other drugs to discuss that are turning out to be really dramatic drugs with promising activity in mantle cell lymphoma. And one of them is a drug called ibrutinib, or you may see it referred to as a BTK inhibitor. And this drug actually targets a unique pathologic feature of many types of B-cell lymphoma, and that is that the surface of these B-cell lymphomas contain a receptor called the B-cell receptor. And one of the reasons why lymphomas are a malignant disease is because it's been discovered that the B-cell receptor, which is sort of a switch that helps turn on the growth of these cells, is constantly turned on. It's like somebody left the lights on in the room all day long. So the switch is always turned on, and the cell gets a signal to just constantly divide and constantly grow. In a normal B lymphocyte, that switch gets turned on when it needs to be turned on, or it gets turned off when it needs to be turned off. But one of the pathologic features of these diseases is the switch is always turned on. Well, ibrutinib is in many ways a unique drug that targets that switch directly. And it actually turns off the switch, so it stops that signal that instructs the cell to grow and divide. And this is a drug that's received a recent designation from the Food and Drug Administration as a breakthrough therapy. So it's recognized now at the level of the government and the regulatory agencies that this is potentially a significant advance in our ability to treat patients with these different diseases. And so Michael Wang from MD Anderson has done some of the very earliest work looking at the activity of ibrutinib in mantle cell lymphoma. And he looked at patients that had received bortezomib and patients that had not received bortezomib, thinking that many patients would be receiving bortezomib and he'd want to see if the drug was equally as active in that population. And in fact, what he discovered is that, again, as a single agent, the drug produced response rates of nearly 70% irrespective of whether you had received prior bortezomib or not. And it also identified the fact that about a quarter, 25% of these patients attained a complete remission. So it's very early in the development of ibrutinib in mantle cell lymphoma, but the early data from Dr. Wang and his colleagues at MD Anderson suggest that ibrutinib has substantial single-agent activity, and as you may see, it's actually a little bit better, maybe twice as good as what we've already seen with lenalidomide and bortezomib, and that the duration of the response of these patients seems to be also quite good, though, again, it's early, and we don't have all the follow-up. The other drug that's come along that's also got very promising activity is a drug that targets part of the biology just downstream of that BTK signaling process that I told you about, and that drug is referred to as a PI3 kinase inhibitor, and the drug that is being studied formerly was referred to as Cal-101, now more affectionately referred to as idelalisib. And this actually really validates the activity of this drug in mantle cell lymphoma, validates the fact that targeting this unique biological axis in mantle cell lymphoma has been associated with really marked therapeutic effects. And so there's some early data that's been generated by Brad Kahl and others that has actually clarified the activity in mantle cell lymphoma, identifying it as a very, very active drug in this disease. And they've even taken it one step further by looking at combinations of this particular drug with Rituxan and looking at it with bendamustine and looking at it in combinations with Rituxan and bendamustine. And what those data generally reveal is that when you add this new drug, idelalisib, with some of the conventional therapies, it appears to improve the complete response rate of patients with various subtypes of B-cell lymphoma. And so one of the major areas moving forward with all of these new drugs is to try to think about how we can integrate them into many of the upfront standards that patients with mantle cell lymphoma have. And as you might imagine, it's a pretty challenging question. It's a very difficult one to answer, given that we're doing better and better in terms of our ability to treat patients with mantle cell lymphoma. And just how do we integrate all these new drugs has really become a challenging question for those of us who are focused on trying to improve the outcome of patients with this disease. The last drug I'll just touch on real briefly is one that got presented at the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting just last month in Chicago, and it's a drug referred to as ABT-199. ABT-199 is a very unique drug that actually targets some of the biology that you might think is representative of all different types of cancers, but happens to be particularly dysregulated in many types of mantle cell lymphoma and follicular lymphoma and chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And that biology is the threshold required to induce death of the malignant cell. As you might imagine, and as Dr. Press alluded to, many cancer cells are characterized by their ability to grow when they shouldn't, but the other side of the coin is they don't die when they're supposed to. So they actually have a survival or an immortality feature to their biology. So if we could find ways to lower the threshold required to induce the death of these malignant cells, we would have then a new therapeutic opportunity. And that's exactly what ABT-199 does. ABT-199 had some predecessors, one called ABT-263, and that drug was found to be very active across a large subtype of diversity of different types of lymphoma. But one of the side effects of that drug was that it produced a marked lowering of patients' platelets, so you couldn't actually escalate the drug to higher doses to get better effects against the tumor. So the sponsors of the drug went back to the laboratory and made new analogs of the compound that didn't have the effect on your platelet count. And what they actually showed in this presentation at ASCO in June was astounding. They actually have only treated a small number of patients in a phase 1 trial. So it's an early phase clinical trial looking at identifying the optimal dose and schedule of the drug and the associated toxicities. So they've only treated about 40 patients. But among those 40 patients, they treated 8 patients with mantle cell lymphoma, and all 8 experienced a response to the therapy. And in fact, most of the patients on the clinical trial experienced a response to the therapy. And again, I've kept highlighting it because it's really important. If one drug targeting the unique biology of these diseases, be it bortezomib, be it lenalidomide, be it ibrutinib, or be it ABT-199, it bodes well for our ability to use those drugs in a fashion that will complement many of the conventional chemotherapies. And so while it's still early in the process for ABT-199, the signal in mantle cell lymphoma has been quite promising and is actually now going to lead to additional clinical trials looking at how one might integrate ABT-199 into some of those conventional therapies you heard about earlier. So that leads me to the second item, which is clinical trials. And you've heard it once already, and you'll hear it again, that many patients sometimes carry a skepticism about clinical trials, and they like to find lots of reasons to say, well, I'm not going in this trial because I'm not a guinea pig, or I'm not going in this trial because it's a placebo-controlled study, because there's a chance I might get a placebo. I think it's very, very important for every patient to recognize that these breakthroughs and our ability to develop them and our ability to integrate them into the standard upfront treatment of every patient requires Food and Drug Administration approval. And the only way to get these drugs to every patient is to be able to do the right clinical trial that convinces the government that this is a good trial, worthy of regulatory approval, and then worthy for every patient that suffers from the disease. So these clinical trials are really important. If you actually look at all of the trials I've just mentioned, most of these trials, almost all of them in fact, have response rates with one drug that is probably better than what any single conventional chemotherapy drug would produce in that same setting. So many of these drugs, by virtue of the fact that they work differently, are able to produce responses where conventional chemotherapy no longer can. And so with each of those drugs that I mentioned, there are now very rapidly accruing clinical trials looking at how to integrate idelalisib or ABT-199 or ibrutinib or lenalidomide into many of the standard treatments for mantle cell lymphoma. Given that we're doing better with the upfront treatment, in some cases, drugs like lenalidomide are being added as maintenance therapies after the definitive induction chemotherapy as a way to sustain that response. And other trials are beginning to look at adding compounds like ibrutinib or idelalisib with rituxan and bendamustine to try to create new, safer, more effective platforms for treating these diseases so we can help patients get to bone marrow transplant, where it's imperative that they be in a complete remission prior to the transplant. So I would actually strongly encourage patients, in fact, to look at those centers where there are very exciting clinical trials for these diseases, because I think not only is it going to help us understand how better to develop these drugs, I think it actually offers the patient the most state-of-the-art and advanced care possible. So the last issue I'll touch on is quality of life, and the bottom line when thinking about quality of life issues is to really develop a rapport with the physicians, nursing staff, because the nurses are the real experts at managing many of the side effects of chemotherapy. Many of the nurses that are involved in clinical research are very adept at managing the side effects of many of these new drugs. And so be it nausea and vomiting or anemia and fatigue, there are lots of things to think about as you try to think about the side effects of these different therapies and the side effects of the disease. And so having an open communication with the nurses involved in your care, they'll actually be able to help you identify potential remedies for those side effects that sometimes have to be tailored to your specific complaints. And they're the ones that actually have the finger on some of these different types of therapies that are most likely to help you manage the side effects of therapy or the disease. So with that, I'll thank Carolyn once again and turn it back to her.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. O'Connor. That was really wonderful and very informative. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Izumi Nakano. Izumi is Associate Director of Patient Services for the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And the Lymphoma Research Foundation has played a very important role in today's program in both Izumi and Brian Tomlinson. Both have worked very hard on both being for the architects of the program today, helping to obtain support for the program today, identify the speakers and topic. They really have just been outstanding, and it's a wonderful resource. And Ms. Nakana is going to present to you the resources of the three support programs and services offered by the Lymphoma Research Foundation. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Nakano.
Thank you, Carolyn, and welcome, everyone. I would like to thank our esteemed faculty, Dr. Owen O'Connor and Dr. Oliver Press, for taking the time to be with us today and for all that you do for the Lymphoma Research Foundation and people affected by mantle cell lymphoma. I would also like to acknowledge Celgene and Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, for supporting today's call. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization devoted exclusively to funding innovative lymphoma research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with up-to-date information about this type of cancer. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. LRF invests millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying a cure through an aggressively funded research program and to helping members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive disease-specific programs and services. To date, LRF has funded over $54 million in lymphoma-specific research. This includes 50 grants totaling nearly $25 million specific to mantle cell lymphoma. In addition, LRF Mantle Cell Lymphoma Consortium, which was formed in January of 2005, is composed of more than 100 laboratory and clinical scientists from North America and Europe who focus their research efforts on mantle cell lymphoma. This consortium group comes together each year and shares their research findings and discuss the future of mantle cell research. Over 50,000 people are served each year by the LRF programs. LRF provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for people dealing with a diagnosis of lymphoma and their caregivers, including our Lymphoma Helpline, where our professional public and mental health staff can assist you in your search for information, resources, and other support, a Clinical Trials Information Service to assist you in your search for clinical trials, the Lymphoma Support Network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences. Print and web-based publications and newsletters, including disease-specific fact sheets, such as our mantle cell lymphoma fact sheet and our fact sheet on relapsed and refractory mantle cell. Webcasts and podcasts are also available on specific types of lymphoma, treatment options, and support topics. We also offer a Focus on Mantle Cell Lymphoma website, which provides disease and treatment information. You can visit the site at www.focusonmcl.org and sign up to receive news and LRF's Mantle Cell Lymphoma disease-specific e-newsletters. Finally, we have in-person patient education conferences on the local, regional, and national level. Our annual North American Educational Forum on Lymphoma is being held this year in Brooklyn, New York, from September 27th to the 29th. For more information, please contact us at 1-800-500-9976 or visit our website at www.lymphoma.org. Carolyn?
Well, thank you very much, Kanye. It was really wonderful, and I really think it's just a wonderful presentation. And also, the Lymphoma Research Foundation is a wonderful resource. And for those of you who may not have called or used the resource, please do contact them. It's just a fountain of information. And I know many of you are already using the resource as well. And our next speaker is Sarah Carley, and Sarah is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. And Sarah is going to review the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care. Sarah?
Thank you, Carolyn. I'd also like to thank everyone on the call. We think we've got a lot of really great information today. So as Carolyn said, I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people coping with mantle cell lymphoma and their loved ones. And I really want to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. I think there are a lot of ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling. We provide that face-to-face in the New York area and then over the telephone nationally. We provide support groups, also face-to-face in the New York area, and then over the telephone and online nationally. We have education about resources, how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help. We also provide some limited financial assistance as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, so the support network. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease. You know, some of the things that I mentioned were financial assistance, so the financial demands of this, physical changes associated with the illness, social adjustment, psychological impact, and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. As you may know, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family and support network. Asking for help by joining a support group or contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. And I really want to stress that you don't have to do this alone. You don't have to walk this path by yourself. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or maybe having similar problems. With the individual counseling, you really have a space that is just yours to voice any concerns that are coming up. And I think the connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. I think feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and treatment. If you're interested in any of cancer care services, please call our HOPE line. It's 1-800-813-HOPE. And that's 1-800-813-4673. And I also recommend if you have access to the Internet, visiting our website, which is www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you'll find a lot of really great information there on your diagnosis and treatment, also just on coping with the illness. I think we learned a lot from today's program. It's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. We're also here to help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize, you know, maybe if you need to rehearse questions that you have for your medical team, you know, we're here to help with that. And really, I mean, I just want you to remember you're not alone in this. We're here for you. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. So thank you for your attention and opportunity to talk today.
Well, thank you very much, Kelly, and thank you for just a wonderful presentation and really for identifying all the services that can be accessed from Cancer Care. So thank you. And now we do have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Kate to bring all of our speakers on board, and if you could explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, we'll give you instructions at the end in terms of how you can contact us to get your questions answered.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from the line of Sherilyn N. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Sherilyn. I have a question in regards to mantle cell when you have low white counts. I'm constantly having to get IVIG infusions. Is this common?
Dr. O'Connor, could you address that?
Well, the question is, why do you have a low white blood count? And so there's a lot of things to think about, and it would be hard for me to give you a definitive treatment recommendation having not met you or seen the details. But when docs see a low white blood count, usually that comes from treatment of the disease. So many of the chemotherapies, you may be aware, not only can cause remission of the disease, but it can also cause a suppression of your normal blood counts. And so that's the first determination. The second is, the second most common reason for low blood count would be due to growth of the lymphoma in your bone marrow. So if that's a cause of the low blood count, then trying to treat the disease so that you can clean out that bone marrow compartment to allow your normal blood cells to grow would be the right treatment. The third most common reason for a low blood count might be due to the fact that many of these chemotherapy drugs can actually damage your mother hematopoietic stem cells, those stem cells that sit in your bone marrow that produce red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. And with a lot of historical exposure to chemotherapy, those stem cells can become damaged and may not function the same way as they did before you got treated. And so it's very important to try to delineate those different causes for white blood cell, for low white blood cell counts, and then to try to treat it accordingly. There may be other caveats, and the use of IVIG has a relatively specific use for the treatment of different immune disorders and for low platelets and other things. But I think it's a complex issue that requires a careful dissection to figure out the cause. And once you know that cause, it's then best to treat that specific entity directly. So it's a complex one you need to have a more detailed conversation with your physician about.
And our next question?
Our next question comes from the line of Marilyn H. Your line is open.
My question also has to do with a sudden drop in low white blood count back into the normal range. And I was undetected for 6 years, indolent, then misdiagnosed, and basically indolent mantle cell for at least 4 years. And I'm feeling uneasy right now about whether I should be moving toward clinical trial, toward something, rather than the watchful waiting for another 3 months.
And your question then is?
No bone marrow biopsy yet.
Okay. Well, thank you for the question. I'm going to ask Dr. Press to address your question in a general way, and then we hope you can take that information back to your
team. Thank you. Yes, I realize this is...
Okay. You know, I guess I'm a little confused by what the question is. I mean, it sounds like she said that her white count dropped back down into the normal range. Does that mean it was elevated because there were circulating mantle cells in the blood? Often that'll be the case. There are some indolent, slow-growing forms of mantle cell in which the lymph nodes actually are all normal and the diseases manifest mainly by the presence of mantle cells in the blood and sometimes in the spleen. And usually those cases progress very slowly and don't require initial treatment. And the indications to begin treatment usually are if people are developing symptoms, that is pain, fevers, drenching night sweats, weight loss, painful enlargement of the spleen, or if their bone marrow is filling up with lymphoma and the blood counts are dropping, as Dr. O'Connor already mentioned, or if there's progressive growth of lymph nodes, particularly if the lymph nodes are getting large and threatening to obstruct normal organs, such as the bile duct, the intestines, the kidneys, et cetera. So those are definite indications to begin treatment, even when patient initially had an indolent form that didn't require treatment.
Excellent. Thank you. I hope that's helpful, and I hope you'll take this back to your treating healthcare team for more insight. Thank you. Our next question?
Our next question comes from the line of Diana L. Your line is open.
Hello, yes. My husband was diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma back in September and underwent 5 rounds of HyperCVAD and then did the stem cell collection, and actually he's on day plus 14 after his transplant. But since March, since the end of his last chemo, HyperCVAD chemo regimen, he has had really ongoing pain issues, achy, like flu-like symptom pain. After the chemo, after this last round of intense chemo going into the bone marrow transplant, sort of under control with various kinds of pain medicine, but despite all of our asking of questions of healthcare professionals, no one seems to be able to tell us if this is something that's seen very often, if it's related to the chemo itself, mm-hmm. Or is it, you know, just maybe something, I mean, we've been trying to figure that out, is it something not at all related, separate inflammatory process, something going on that we can't discover? So my question is just, is there, is that seen in patients? Does it, and if it is, does it resolve after a while, after the treatment? And if not, you know, is there anything recommended so that they're not living with this constant pain, you know, and can we get the cause of it is what I really want to know. But if not, can we manage it?
You know, in a case like this, one really needs to examine the patient and evaluate them. But, I mean, there are many things that can cause pain in patients who are being treated for lymphoma. Usually the lymph nodes themselves are not painful till they get very large, but the spleen can get large and be painful. People get growth factor shots often during the course of chemotherapy, and the growth factor shots make the normal bone marrow grow inside the bones and compress on the bones and cause diffuse, achy pains throughout the body. And then there's just a lot of malaise and fatigue that goes along with chemotherapy and transplant that makes patients uncomfortable. In this particular case, it's a little hard to figure out what the pain is due to. It's not something that most patients have, although, as I mentioned, there are many causes of possible pain in patients with lymphoma. I would give reassurance that I think the treatment that her husband has received is an excellent treatment. It's the treatment I would choose for myself, to be honest, to get hyper-CVAD and then an autologous transplant. And I suspect that the pain and achiness will go away with time as he gets further away from the transplant.
Excellent. Okay, excellent, Tim. And our next question, please.
Our next question comes from the line of Jim J. Your line is open.
Yes. My name is Jim. I was just diagnosed 3 months ago with mantle cell, and it's in the colon. I'm going to be starting treatment. They want to do R-CHOP, and after that treatment, do a stem cell transplant. You were discussing drugs that are new when there is a relapse. Have these patients taken these drugs after doing a stem cell, or did they forego the stem cell transplant and then go right to these newer drugs that are in trials and so on and so forth?
Thank you for that question. Dr. O'Connor, could you address this question?
Sure. So there are many of the drugs that I mentioned, and before I go on, there's a lot of details about your case I don't know. So I don't know if the disease in the GI tract is the only disease in your body. I don't know how big it is. I don't know how much you have. I don't know if you're symptomatic. So there's a lot of detail that helps the doc sort of figure out exactly what's the right therapy for you. But a couple of comments. There are right now probably the biggest, one of the bigger trials being done in mantle cell lymphoma is being sponsored by the cooperative group called ECOG, and they have a number of trials where they're looking at bendamustine combinations in this particular disease with Rituxan and other new drugs, lenalidomide, and they're trying to use some of these new drugs earlier in the natural history of the disease, and they're actually looking at not in a randomized fashion, but in an alternating fashion. They're going to actually look at four different treatment regimens from the very beginning to see how best to use these drugs in that setting. So if you had access to a academic site or a community site that was involved in the cooperative group studies, I would highly recommend exploring those possibilities. Many of the other trials that are looking at new drugs in mantle cell lymphoma are first starting by trying to establish the activity and merit of the drug in patients with relapsed or refractory disease. There is a study, so some of the trials are looking at integration up front, but most of them are looking for approval strategies based upon patients with relapsed or refractory disease. Another thing to sort of bring up with your doc is whether CHOP or CHOP-based chemotherapy has been the community standard for a long time, but there is a bit of controversy around whether standard R-CHOP is the best first therapy to get or whether one should be using other induction chemotherapy, that's the name we give to that first treatment that you get, should have a drug called Ara-C or cytarabine. And one of the advantages of the Hyper-CVAD regimen is that it has a Part B component which uses Ara-C, and one of the presumed advantages of the Nordic Lymphoma Study Group regimen is that it also uses higher doses of Ara-C integrated into that CHOP-based treatment. And so there's also recent data from the American Society of Hematology meeting in last December looking at a regimen alternating with a regimen called DHAP, which integrates Ara-C. And so there's a lot of clinical data pointing to the potential merits of Ara-C being used in this frontline treatment of patients with mantle cell lymphoma in terms of its ability to get you into a good complete remission and then try to bridge you to transplant. So in answer to the first part of your question, most of the regimens looking at new drugs are being studied in the relapse setting. But at the moment, we don't have any data to suggest that any of those regimens integrating new drugs are an appropriate surrogate for bone marrow transplant. So as Dr. Press alluded to earlier, I believe strongly that a bone marrow transplant, as long as you're physiologically fit for the procedure, is the proper thing to is the proper procedure or the proper treatment to get after that frontline chemotherapy. So none of these new drugs yet have been found to supplant the merits of autologous stem cell transplant.
Excellent. Another is that a question from one of our online participants about a woman who's emailing about her mom who's in her 70s, and actually the issue is whether she would be able to be a candidate for a stem cell transplant, autologous stem cell transplant. And I wondered if you could comment on that, Dr. Press and Dr. O'Connor.
Sure. Well, I can give you my view and the view of our institution, and that is that we go largely by physiologic age rather than biologic age. That is, that we don't go strictly by how old a person is in years, but rather whether they have a lot of other health issues, et cetera. And as I briefly mentioned before, we routinely do transplants in people up to the age of 70 and even in the early 70s at our center, unless the patient has bad heart or lung disease or kidney failure or other issues. So at our center, she would be eligible for a transplant, but it really depends on looking at the patient and seeing what other issues are going on. Transplants have become a lot safer in the last decade or so as we learn better how to avoid a lot of the side effects, infections, and do better supportive care.
And I agree completely. We also don't look at strict age or a strict number to make this determination. We look at how healthy the patient is, and I think, again, just to reiterate what's been said, some of the best data in terms of looking at patient outcome, at least again in my estimation, is seen in those patients who have a good response to that induction chemotherapy with all the caveats I mentioned earlier, and who are able to then go on to receive consolidation-based treatment in the form of the stem cell transplant. So I wouldn't view the transplant as a terribly noxious thing. It's obviously got its risks and benefits, but you need a good detailed dialogue with your physician and your healthcare team to understand those risks real well as you make those decisions going forward.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been extraordinary, and all of you who've actually queued up both online and on the telephone to ask questions. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I would like to actually let you all know about all the services that you can access both from the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and to remind you to access both of those organizations for any of the questions that you might not have had a chance to ask or may think of asking over the next few days or weeks to come. You have the phone numbers for both organizations. For the Lymphoma Research Foundation, they can be called at 1-800-500-9976. And for Cancer Care, it's 1-800-813-4673. so all of us have our staff available to answer your questions and concerns. Most importantly, as we conclude today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with mantle cell cancer, with lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, or with cancer in general. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we're all here to help you. And so we're simply a telephone call away or visiting our websites. Thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.